taking to the streets to protest the crisis at the border. Welcome to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Tom Hudson is off today. Well, tomorrow, hundreds of thousands of Americans, enraged by the separation of immigrant families at the U.S.-Mexico border, will take to the streets, and they'll be protesting a controversial Trump administration policy that has caused the detention of thousands of undocumented immigrants. These groups will call on the government to reunite more than 2,000 migrant children taken from their parents. Families Belong Together rallies, as they're being called, are planned in more than 200 cities across the U.S., including every major city here in Florida. Now, as the protesters rally, a judge has ordered that families be reunited as soon as possible. That's turning up the heat on child detention centers like those in South Florida that are housing some of the migrant children. They are racing against the clock to meet the deadline imposed by the judge. President Trump, under intense pressure, of course, reversed his zero-tolerance policy of family separation. And a federal judge this week says that the kids have to be united with their parents in 30 days or within 14 days if the children are younger than six. But it's still unclear how exactly that's going to happen. Meanwhile, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has created an unaccompanied children reunification task force to try to get these families put back together. So can the kids get back to their parents? What about these Florida detention centers? Here with more, we welcome Erica Coran. She's an attorney who runs the Immigration Clinic at Florida Coastal School of Law. Professor Coran, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
And wherever you are in Florida, we want to hear your thoughts and comments about the border crisis, the separation of families, and the hundreds of rallies planned for tomorrow, a day of action called Families Belong Together. What are your thoughts? Give us a call. 305-995-1800 from anywhere in Florida. And with marches planned in every city around the state, this will be front and center tomorrow, Professor Coran. At the same time, bring us up to speed on where things are with this. A federal judge in California issued an injunction Tuesday, a nationwide injunction, that forbids the government from separating any more children from their parents. And she put a very strict deadline on the government to get kids back with their parents, kids younger than five, within 14 days. How difficult a job is that going to be?
I think it's going to be very difficult. And one of the things in her decision was she pointed out that the government has a very clear system of keeping track of property, but hasn't developed a clear system to keep track of these children. And so they have to locate the parents with whether they're in the immigration detention system. The other problem is that the decision doesn't say that they have to be released. It says they have to be reunified with their parents. So there are only a few family detention facilities, and they're not in compliance with the Flores decision. And so there's facilities in Dilley and Karnes, Texas, and the Reading, Pennsylvania. And so the Department of Justice has filed to modify that Flores decision so they can detain children in facilities that are not in compliance, so unlicensed facilities. And I think that's really alarming. So that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be released. It means they're going to be detained in unlicensed facilities with their parents.
And in Florida, just over 100 of these children that were separated from their parents at the border were brought here to South Florida. What do we know about what's taking place in South those centers?
So we in North Florida used to have facilities that housed unaccompanied children, and so they closed those facilities a couple of years ago. We used to provide legal representation to children in those facilities. But they have social workers that try to locate the parents, arrange phone calls, and so I assume what's happening is that they're trying to locate the parents, get a determination. And then under the Flores settlement, they have to detain children in the least restrictive setting. So if they're going to be moved to a facility with their parents, they have to figure out where that is. And right now, the Department of Justice is asking a federal judge to modify that decision, which I think would be tragic.
What about the fact that so much thought was put into how to separate families, and it looks as though little to no thought was given to how children would ever be reunited with their parents.
Yeah.
As you pointed out, this judge said the government does a better job of tracking people's property than tracking people's children.
Right. And I think it's because the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice, they're not versed in the housing of children, and they're not child care providers. And I think that is really demonstrated by this situation. And not a lot of thought was put into this. And I think studies have shown that the detention of asylum seekers does not deter them from trying to come to the United States. What they're facing back in their countries causes them to take those risks regardless of potential incarceration.
Particularly countries like Guatemala and Honduras, where people have been fleeing gang and drug-related violence. Now, what about the logistical challenge of bringing these kids and parents together? There are more than 2,000 children scattered really to the four winds all over the country in lots of different housing situations. Some people who've been following this think the end result could be that the administration could end up being forced to release a lot of these families from custody, which is the exact opposite of what the administration wanted with the zero tolerance policy, correct?
Yes. But I think what's missing from this and what the public needs to understand is releasing people from detention under the right circumstances with the right results, a right support system, results in people being more likely to show up for court. Now, punishing people for criminal unlawful entry could require a jail sentence, but typically people are sentenced to no more than a couple of days. I'm not sure that that's a big deterrent anyway. Immigration detention feels very much exactly like being in a prison or a jail setting. But releasing people from immigration detention, you can put them on ankle monitors. It can be on all sorts of check-in systems or shelter programs. We represent a lot of families that were released from Dilley and Carnes, and they show up for court, and they have a much higher success on their asylum claims if they have lawyers and social workers and people supporting them.
Across the country tomorrow, there will be a national day of action, rallies under the banner of Families Belong Together. People will be protesting and marching in every major Florida city demanding the reunification of children with parents. What are your thoughts and comments? Call us up from anywhere in Florida here on the Florida Roundup. 305-995-1800 is the number to join the conversation. Maurice is in Plantation, Florida. Hey, Maurice, good afternoon. You're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi, as a Democratic voter, I see a lot of local politicians criticizing Debbie Wasserman Schultz for her support of a budget that would have put $11 million towards funding detention centers in Florida. And they cry out that, hey, we don't want these centers in our communities. I also remember being really strongly against funding building a wall as a deterrent to keep people out. What are Tim Cannavo was one of the politicians who was really critical of Wasserman Schultz. But what are the ideas that other lawmakers are putting on the table to deter unlawful immigration in this country?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for that, Maurice. And of course, that has been the absolute bane of Congress's existence for how many years now? This absolute failure to come to comprehensive immigration reform. Now, South Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, alongside Senator Bill Nelson, was actually turned away from one of those facilities last week. As Maurice pointed out, there's a NIMBY aspect to this. Some neighborhoods might not want undocumented immigrants coming to their neighborhood. And he asked about legislation. Wednesday, a compromise bill was negotiated on the Republican side of the House on this whole matter. It was voted down by about 70 votes. It didn't, or maybe even more votes. It didn't even make it. They were trying to address how to end family separations, how to pay for what President Trump wants, a border wall, the DACA fix, the group of young people known as Dreamers who want to stay in this country. And so, you know, every time we talk about this, what we see over and over again is utter failure, Professor Coran, on the part of lawmakers to address this issue, which a majority of Americans keep saying they want fixed.
Yeah, no, it's definitely been happening throughout my entire career practicing immigration law, is that every time we come close, we aren't able to come together on things. I think it, with regard to family detention or immigration detention in general, I think one thing that the public needs to understand is the cost of detaining individuals in family immigration detention centers is around $300 a day. And the cost of some of these alternatives to detention, such as ankle monitoring and case management systems, where they check in, they go to the homes of the immigrants. I have clients that the ICE officers would go to their homes once every couple of weeks. They were on call-in systems, are much cheaper, and still ensure that people come to court. Because immigration detention is not punitive. It's just to ensure that a person goes to court and follows the court's ruling.
Why haven't ankle bracelets been more widely adopted then?
I think, I mean, and the president is referring to this as catch and release, and sort of inferring that we need immigration detention as a deterrent, that these families, particularly from the Central American countries, are coming here because it's so easy to get in, rather than looking at the push-pull factors. Why are all of these people fleeing since the, you know, 2013 to now? What is the crisis? And I can say what's happening, what I've been seeing, is an increase of women and girls. And women and girls don't tend to migrate. It's difficult for women and girls, and risky and dangerous in ways that's different than for men and women with children. And they're facing tremendous peril to come to the United States. And they're doing so because what they face back home is far worse.
What are some of the stories you've heard?
So we have clients who are fleeing severe domestic violence that is not properly investigated or prosecuted. We have children and girls fleeing the gang-based violence, the children that are being forced to join gangs, and the corruption in the government, the governments in these countries having you know, ties to the gangs, or law enforcement in these countries having ties, so they don't have any recourse. They can't escape.
Let's go to some more of your calls here on the Florida Roundup. 305-995-1800. Warren is in Delray Beach right now. Hey, Warren, how are you? Go ahead.
Oh, I live in a land of great justice called America, so I could be doing much better. On that score, just after listening to the first part of this program, in which my friends, the iguanas, were maligned and made into,
iguanas. Do you have iguanas in your backyard?
I used to keep iguanas on my terrace. I started keeping them since the age of 10. And when you tame them, they're like cats, only they look like dinosaurs, which for me is perfect. Charming and offensive creatures. But let's get on to this. My grandparents were immigrants. My mother was an immigrant. My cousin was an immigrant. I was a repatriated immigrant. I don't care where someone was born. I don't care whether you were born on the Skrull planet if you're a nice person. However, even on this station, which I support, I never hear a program about horrible online applications that keep college graduates, let alone other worthy human beings, out of work, because one of the requirements to get a job is currently to have one. And here we have criminals of our own. What happens when we arrest them? Do they never get separated from their children? And now we're talking about, and they're good people.
Well, you know, and Warren, let's be clear, though. Let's be clear that people crossing the border have committed, under our law, a misdemeanor.
Okay, they've committed a misdemeanor, which is still a crime. What, I never hear people talking about what we're going to do to employ these people. I don't mind how people come, really. I don't care whether they swim here. After 25 million people whom no one will hire, Americans who are here have good gainful employment.
Okay. I understand your point. Sure. And I think many Americans share your view on that.
And one more thing, love. I never want to hear again that these people are taking jobs Americans don't want. Because when American employers are made to pay what a human being should earn in order to live a first world lifestyle, a lot more people. I would be out in Boca Raton picking tomatoes right now if I could take home $10 an hour.
Okay, I got you. Let's get Erica Coran to answer all of that.
Well, one thing with regard to asylum seekers and people seeking refuge in the United States, they aren't allowed to apply for work authorization unless their case hasn't been decided within 150 days. So they can't work unless they win their case, in which case then they are eligible for lawful permanent residence and the ability to work in the United States and live in the United States. And then they would apply for jobs just the same way anyone would. But they're not allowed to work until that point. And I think it's a different group of individuals than economic migrants, people just coming to work or for a better life. These are individuals that are coming fleeing persecution. One point, too, the president said, well, these people should be seeking asylum in Mexico or wherever they first land. We haven't been resettling refugees. That would put them in refugee status if they were trying to get to the United States. They would be applying and at the U.S. consulate or wherever they would. But we're not even accepting refugees. So people are coming because they're facing persecution. That's not to say that we don't, as an international community, need to look into what can be done to resolve these issues that are causing people to flee. Because, you know, I think most people would rather be safe in their own country.
Sure. And what about his point, though, that he feels that if employers would pay more competitively for many of these types of jobs that undocumented immigrants do, that there would be less people coming across the border to take those jobs?
Yeah, and I think you do need to start with holding employers accountable, absolutely, to make sure that. And I think asylum seekers are different than people coming to get jobs. I think that's
There's two different buckets of people.
Yeah. And if you're coming, you know, to work and an employer is hiring you and they don't have authorization to do so, but that's going to mean an increase in cost. So I encourage everyone to think about, you know, why is the thing that I'm purchasing or the hotel I'm staying at so cheap? Is it possibly because this particular business is not following our immigration laws?
In particular, even here in Florida, if you get a tomato from a supermarket, chances are an illegal or rather an undocumented person picked that tomato and wasn't getting paid a living wage to do it.
Right.
It's just one example.
And human trafficking and involuntary servitude is a big problem. In Florida, we are ranked third in the nation on human trafficking. So I think you start by holding employers accountable in that regard. Absolutely.
And it's our Florida Roundup this Friday as we talk about the biggest stories of the week across the state. Florida is playing a role in the big national story, of course. The crisis at the southern border, the separation of children from families, our immigration policies, what's next for the nation, rallies planned around the state and the country tomorrow as protesters speak out about the separation of kids from families. We're going to take a very short break and then continue this discussion with your calls here on the Florida Roundup. And the number to join us is 305-995-1800. What are your thoughts about all this? What are your thoughts about this weekend's day of action? President Trump's call for a border wall. Immigration. We're going to keep the conversation going. It's the Florida Roundup coming up after a short break with your phone calls after the news. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Lots of calls about the immigration debate we're having here on the show. Let's go to Daryl in St. Augustine, Florida. Hi, Daryl. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Just a couple of points. First off, only America could we find some way to profit from homeless refugees running for their lives. Arrest a woman, arrest a child, throw them in prison, pay the ICE guy $75,000 a year, tax the citizen to feed them and imprison them and, you know, have the money passed on to private prison. So we're, in effect, profiting from these.
Right. And so I think the other point you wanted to make was you think a solution is to prosecute the businesses which hire undocumented people?
Absolutely. You don't see them throwing the people in jail that actually hire all of these
people. Sure.
You see them throwing the ones in that don't have jail.
I've got your point, Daryl.
Tyson Foods.
Got your point.
Go ahead.
Professor Coran.
Okay.
I think enforcement at the level of the employers is important, but I also think employers are saying that, look, they cannot get the appropriate workers, and it's not just about wages. And we do need to take a look at, and this is, again, where Congress has failed to act in the past 30 years to effectuate comprehensive immigration reform that allows employers to lawfully hire the workers that they need.
So ultimately, every voter needs to demand this of their representative and senator in Congress.
Get informed and get in contact with your representative.
Absolutely. And I know that's not the answer everybody wants to hear right now, but it really is the only solution in the end. We have to keep insisting on that. Always good to talk with you. Erica Corrin, who runs the Immigration Clinic at Florida Coastal School of Law. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, the Republican candidates for Florida governor talked about immigration and some other issues on a Fox News debate last night. It was televised from Kissimmee. Adam Putnam, the state's agriculture commissioner, leads Ron DeSantis, a congressman from the Palm Coast area, in the latest poll of the state's Republican voters. After last night's debate, some viewers called the winner not Putnam or DeSantis, but President Trump. That's because both candidates took pains to constantly praise the president, often at the expense of discussing Florida issues. Here's Putnam.
Your question about out-of-state influence in Florida, the real danger isn't what's going on this stage. It's the fact that George Soros and Tom Steyer are trying to hijack Florida politics. And it's not because they care about how long we spend in traffic on I-4. And it's not because they care about the quality of our schools in Northwest Florida. And it's not because they care about the quality of water in Lake Okeechobee. It's because they care about one thing and one thing only, and that is defeating our president, taking back the White House. And that won't happen in Florida, and that won't happen on our watch.
Now, on the Democratic side, it's a crowded field of five candidates seeking their party's nomination in a tight race. Former Congresswoman Gwen Graham from the Panhandle and former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine are currently neck and neck atop the latest Democratic polls. So what's the state of this race? Now, keep in mind the primary is coming up before you know it. Elections officials start sending out mail ballots in just 4 weeks, 2 weeks for overseas voters. And many of those voters still remain undecided. We talked about the governor's race earlier this week with Adam Smith, political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Take a listen. So there's a new poll out looking at the Florida governor's race. Let's start with the Republicans. It looks as though Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam is holding on to his lead over Congressman Ron DeSantis. Your thoughts, let's begin on the Republican side with your thoughts about where the race is for the GOP.
Well, it does. There have been multiple polls that show Commissioner Putnam fairly comfortably ahead of DeSantis. That's probably not surprising because Adam Putnam has spent a great deal of money on TV ads, and those do seem to make a difference in races where the candidates are not especially well-known. DeSantis is just starting his ad, so nothing's over, but DeSantis has some catching up to do.
Sure. And as you said, it's early yet. But going up on TV in Florida, the importance of that can't be overestimated. What do you think about the way Putnam is pushing what he calls a grassroots appeal and going to so many events all over the state, really the old-fashioned way of doing it? On the other hand, Ron DeSantis is touting President Trump's endorsement. And he's doing a lot of campaigning, frankly, on Fox News, which is a brand new way to run for governor. Is that a gamble, I guess, that Ron DeSantis can, will it pay off for him? Or is the traditional way of campaigning in the end, do you see that working for Adam Putnam?
It is a gamble. I'm sure if Adam Putnam were invited to be on Fox News as often as Ron DeSantis is, he would happily do the same thing. But, you know, the argument which makes some sense from the DeSantis people is every time you go to a chicken dinner in Hardy County or Clay County, you're reaching a fraction of the voters that you do in one appearance on the Sean Hannity show. So in a way, it's certainly more cost effective to do what DeSantis is doing. The trouble is Adam Putnam is not just running a grassroots campaign. He's also running a campaign where he's shattering all records for raising money and spending money.
Right. Let's talk about these eye-popping totals for Putnam. He's getting all of the traditional donor support in Florida. Big Sugar comes to mind. As you look at the donor base for these two candidates, Ron DeSantis has a lot of out-of-state support, on the other hand.
Hey, Ron DeSantis has sort of carved out the position as kind of a movement conservative, sort of a what we used to call Tea Party conservative. So he has a lot of hardcore conservative supporters like the Koch brothers and people of that ilk. I'm not saying the Koch brothers in particular, but people of that ilk are getting behind him. Some multimillionaires and a couple billionaires are getting behind DeSantis. And I do think once Ron DeSantis doesn't have the money that Putnam has, but once he starts airing ads and presumably does, pointing out that Putnam, you know, voted for cash for clunkers, voted for pay raises, voted for the Wall Street bailout, those could be very damaging to Putnam.
And what's his strategy to come back from that, do you think?
I think it's probably just money, and to hope that he's built up enough of a lead and he's got enough of a grassroots campaign and a get-out-the-vote effort that he can withstand that stuff. And he's also, you know, not allowing Ron DeSantis is campaigning like the Trump endorsed and the real Donald Trump candidate, and Adam Putnam is basically staking at the same position as a number one fan of Donald Trump, even if he doesn't have Trump's endorsement.
Okay, and right now we're speaking with Adam Smith of the Tampa Bay Times about the jockeying for a position in the race for Florida governor. Let's talk about the Democrats now. Four candidates all battling it out in the polls. Former Congresswoman Gwen Graham, former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine, Palm Beach investor Jeff Green, and Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, also Chris King, businessman from Orlando. Actually, it's five candidates now, I should say, with this late entry of Jeff Green down in Palm Beach. Such a crowded primary for Democrats to look through. None of these candidates have massive name recognition, although Philip Levine seems to be the first one up on television, and that seems to be paying off for him in the early polling. As you look at these candidates, Adam, who do you think is going to break away from the pack, or will no one break out from the pack in this race? Are there just too many people running and just no sort of known quantity in this group for our voters to consider?
Yeah, this one is so sort of unformed, it's another example of TV spending mattering a great deal. A lot of people... When Philip Levine, who's worth north of $100 million from the cruise ship industry, when he started spending money at the beginning of this year on TV ads, a lot of people, a lot of his rivals sniffed and sneered, but that spending has really put him in the lead, basically. And it looks like it's a Philip Levine versus Gwen Graham, those clearly the two front runners, but in a five-person race, and especially when you've got a billionaire like Jeff Green, who's already spending millions of dollars, you know, somebody can win this with a quarter of a vote. The winner could come in, so it's still sort of up for grabs.
Do you think that's why Green got in at this late date? He figured, I have a shot. It's just such a scrum of candidates. Maybe I have a shot.
You know, you have if you are have unlimited money, and he does, you have the luxury of waiting almost as long as you want, and we saw that. 8 years ago when Rick Scott, very late in the game, suddenly entered the Republican primary for governor and then beat Bill McCollum, who's very much of a known quantity. So Jeff Green, I think he's been playing this for a long time, and he just decided he'd save himself the headaches of being a target early on, and he'd wait as long as he could before announcing.
Let's talk about these one by one, beginning with Gwen Graham, a former congresswoman from the Panhandle. She's the daughter, of course, of former governor and Senator Bob Graham. She's seen as the establishment pick. How is her appeal going to play among Democrats, particularly women, who would like to see a female governor? It would be a first for this state. Certainly, there will be a lot of Democrats that are still upset over Hillary Clinton losing the election. How does that play in Graham's favor?
I think especially this cycle where we're seeing women candidates win in election after election across the country, it's got to be a significant help. And I will say, you know, clearly the Republicans that I talk to, and I talk to a lot of them, overwhelmingly think she's the toughest candidate to beat in the general election. But that said, when she was in Congress, she represented a Republican-leaning North Florida district So she took some, you know, arguably conservative votes, sometimes differing with President Obama. So, you know, you've got a very fired up liberal base of the Democratic Party, and it's, and she's not really setting the world on fire on a campaign trail. So she's no shoo-in. Normally, Democrats do pick the establishment most moderate candidate to nominate for governor, but that's uncertain this year.
Uncertain this year. Yeah, as you mentioned, there's this fiery progressive base now on the Democratic side, which is what we've been seeing for years now on the right with the Tea Party on the Republican side. And we saw a Democratic socialist, a 28-year-old Latina woman in New York, beat out the incumbent Democratic congressman the other night. And that, I think, was an early warning shot for what many establishment Democrats can be seeing as they go around and campaign in these primaries. So is Gwen Graham too moderate, too centrist now for this base? And can these other candidates capitalize on that, particularly Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum? He's certainly trying to stake out that most progressive lane in the governor's race. Can he capitalize on that enthusiasm and that anger on the left from progressives?
I think we'll see. I think both Gillum and Chris King are clearly the most liberal candidates. Chris King is really putting out, and at some of these debates, they are the most, they are the real standouts in many respects. And Gillum in particular is really got a lot of the grassroots or liberal activists excited. He's a great speaker. He's very charismatic. Comes across as a very authentic, good guy. And I think I've heard people say that of all the Democrats running, the ones who seem less like politicians, like typical politicians, are King and Gillum.
Right. And not the typical politicians, but has there ever been a non-typical politician like that that's won a statewide election?
Well, maybe Claude Kirk. But yeah, you'd have to go by. Usually we go with pretty typical politicians, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, in most states, and particularly this one. So let's talk about a couple of these other races. I want to get your thoughts about what's going on in the Senate race between Bill Nelson and Rick Scott. And the incumbent Senator Bill Nelson, the Democrat, he's had some really successful news cycles over the last week or two, as he's jumped on the issue of children being held in South Florida detention centers that were separated from their parents at the southern border as they were trying to cross illegally into this country. The latest poll, though, still shows Governor Scott up over Bill Nelson by a few points. What's the strategy for both of these candidates as they move ahead to November?
Well, I feel like I'm starting to sound like a broken record in some respects, but Rick Scott has already spent more than $20 million on TV ads, which is extraordinary so early. And yet, in a way, you could argue he should be significantly more ahead of Bill Nelson, given all that spending and given the fact that Nelson is despite being in office for a long, long time, is sort of unknown to a lot of voters. So I think that's probably going to be most statewide elections in Florida are squeakers, come down to a point or two, and all indications are that this will too. And of course, Trump looms large over everything.
Right. In every major race, how do you see the Donald Trump factor breaking in Florida, in this swing state? As someone who's covered politics for a long time, you know, we're still a couple of months out from the primary. But can the who's going to win the turnout battle when you have a president who has 90% approval among Republican primary voters? And at the same time, you've got Democrats more enthusiastic and fired up about voting in a midterm, I think, Adam, than they've been in a very long time. Which side is going to turn their people out in this off-year election here in Florida, do you think?
Well, yeah, somebody who's been covering Florida politics for a long, long time, I would say I have no idea. But normally, Democrats have a pretty weak turnout in midterm elections. But like you say, the Democratic base is as fired up as I've ever seen them in a long, long time. And the Republican base is very fired up for Trump, obviously. And the Republican candidates for governor, they may have been holding their nose while when they voted for him for Trump for president in the general election. but now they are basically trying to super glue them to Trump. And the real question is, once we get to the general election, is that going to backfire in a big way, especially among independents that do not seem too enamored of the president?
Right. And what do the numbers show in a state with a pretty high chunk of independents? Say you're Ron DeSantis and you've really campaigned heavily on your association with the president and his endorsement. Is that going to backfire on him in this state come fall?
Certainly the Democrats think it will. And if you watch Rick Scott, who really was an early Trump supporter during the presidential election, he has clearly calculated that he doesn't want to get too close to the president. He's going to keep his distance. And he doesn't have a primary opponent, so he can afford to do that. But he clearly is acting like he thinks Trump is a liability in the general election. And Ron DeSantis, you know, probably his only chance of winning the Republican primary is to exploit Trump's popularity among Republicans, so he really has no choice.
They always say, you know, pivoting from a primary is hard. As you move to a more moderate general election voter base this year, I would think it's going to be harder than ever. This is a really tough year for that, it seems.
Especially on some of the liberals on the Democratic side, we have probably a tough time too, but especially on the Republican side, where both Putnam and DeSantis are just basically acting like Trump can do no wrong ever.
Well, Adam Smith of the Tampa Bay Times, it's always good to get your political insights. Thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And in a moment, what is cryptocurrency? And furthermore, what does a cryptocurrency czar do? Well, guess what? Florida is getting one. That's because there's a need to regulate this crypto industry in the state. If you always wondered what cryptocurrency was, but were too embarrassed to ask, guess what? We're going to answer all those questions in just a few moments. Get on the line now as we talk crypto here on the Florida Roundup at 305-995-1800. Your crypto questions answered after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Tom is off this week. Well, a brand new position is being created here in Florida, cryptocurrency chief. Yeah. Florida's chief financial officer, Jimmy Petronas, says there is a need to oversee the growing crypto industry in the state. And he's ordered his office to create a position that will manage the application of current insurance and securities laws to what are known as initial coin offerings, ICOs, or digital currencies. Now, this person will develop a regulatory framework for crypto within the state. So are you confused about cryptocurrency? Maybe you've heard of Bitcoin. That's the most famous cryptocurrency. But if you're wondering what all this is about, you're not alone. Why is crypto growing and how does crypto work? We have someone to answer those questions, Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal. He is here to explain the world of crypto to us all. Hey, Tim.
How are you doing?
Good to talk to you. All right, let's first begin by explaining what cryptocurrency is.
I love the fact that whenever you say cryptocurrency, you have this tone in your voice like that's all made up. and you should have that tone in your voice because it is.
It is made up.
That doesn't mean that it's not a real actual thing, that there are people who have made boatloads of money on, and that they see as a way for the future, both for investment and some of the technology underpinning cryptocurrency can be used for other things such as medical records and such like. So you mentioned Bitcoin, probably the most famous one, and I'm going to simplify this really, really simplified. It is the radio. I can't pull out the charts and graphs, but easy way to think about it. You look at a dollar bill you have in your pocket. It has a serial number on it. So if you have money, I give you that dollar. There's no record that I had it. There's no record that I gave it to you. You can do anything with it. Once you move into digital currency, most digital currency can be tracked. Think of when you use your credit card online. Usually that's a good thing. But if you want a secure, anonymous way of transferring money, that's when you get into digital currency. So picture that serial number on your dollar bill. The technology underpinning digital currency basically means that there's a system that you can give that dollar bill to someone and prove it.
Let's go to James in Jacksonville. Hi, James. What's your crypto question? Hey, James, go ahead. All right, we lost James.
Probably the black helicopter.
Oh, there you are.
Sorry, I had the car on mute. I had the phone on mute.
Go ahead, James.
Real quick, crypto is pretty new to me, but the way you're describing the way that you can track it and really sort of there's a lot of in a way safeguards to the the use within that system of whatever cryptocurrency you're using. How are the concerns for cryptocurrency compared to the concerns for our current monetary system? As far as, with crypto, it doesn't seem like there's a central organization deciding when to create new coins per se, at least from my understanding.
Yep.
Whereas we, in our monetary system, we have the Fed in with their relationship with the Treasury making, money as they see. And without the demand for the dollar, if that were gone away and there was no commodity demand or anything like that, what would happen with the dollar, and what's holding the dollar's value up if it doesn't have the same scarcity system that the cryptos would? Take my comments off there.
So he had a lot of good, interesting points, some of which get into almost a philosophical thing of what is money. I'm sure you'd love to turn this show into a, half hour long, just like, in depth, what is money anyway?
Well, when you think about it, all money is made up.
Right. Fiat currency is basically a fiction that we all believe in.
Exactly.
So let's not go too far down that trail before, the black helicopters get us as well. But but the idea that Bitcoin, just to pick one, doesn't have any intrinsic value, but everybody has agreed that it has value, and that value fluctuates widely. If you got some of these first Bitcoins, they're worth, many, many times what they originally were trading at. The number of Bitcoins that will eventually be in circulation is capped. But as the caller said, there is no central repository. There's nothing like the Federal Reserve trying to manage that supply of the money. I should real quick just to fork off here a little bit. You have Bitcoin, you have digital currencies. Initial coin offerings, which are the other thing that come up in this regulatory thing, are a slightly different thing. They're together because ICOs are typically bought with digital currency. An ICO is, in its basic conception, is almost like pre-investing in a company. And this is where this cyber currency czar comes into play. So say I'm opening up a bar, and to fund that, I can either sell shares, which would obviously be a security, or I can basically say, give me money and I'll give you a token that you can buy beer with. Mm-hmm. That would be a beer coin.
Let's go to JD in Fort Lauderdale now. Hi, JD. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My question is, if you have a new corporation that is interested in possibly doing their own in-house cryptocurrency to be able to do SMS text messaging services in, say, Central South America and the Caribbean, what would be the best way to raise the initial offerings for the cryptocurrency, for crypto dinero is the name of it?
I mean, the typical, that's almost like a textbook sort of case for why you would do an ICO, with the idea being that you would raise the money to build out the system, and then those coins could be used to actually, I assume in this case, probably to pay for the text messaging. So the idea is that the business doing it
Are there any firms right now doing that in Boca, Palm Beach area?
Not that I know of. But honestly, the flurry of ICOs that are coming out is there's dozens every day. So there's none that I'm aware of. And if that is an idea you have, it's probably something worth jumping on.
Yeah, good luck, JD. And because so many people are jumping into this space, this is why we see the state's CFO creating a position to oversee this burgeoning market, a regulatory framework.
Well, at least one of the reasons.
And one of the reasons.
It does need regulation.
Exactly. And let me ask you about that, Tim. Jimmy Patronis, the state CFO, is saying we can't allow this industry to expand unfettered and unchecked, with the potential for so many, including our large population of seniors, to be exploited. What's the potential for scams and exploitation?
They're huge. And there is a, I should just say, when I said, one of the reasons, one of the other reasons potentially could be that he's in a race for the CFO job. And sometimes when people are running front office, I not to be cynical, because, I hate that, but but it's possible that someone would make an announcement like this, because it does look good on as you run for a position. But the possibility of scams are rife. Think of, you watch a cable news channel and you see all of the cash for gold sort of things.
Yeah.
There is the idea that if you're getting sophisticated investors and you're exposing them to kind of a cutting edge sort of investing scheme, that's really ripe for people to get taken advantage of. I mean, as editor of the Business Journal, my professional advice is if you don't understand ICOs or cryptocurrency now and you're hearing this, you probably should not be investing in it.
Sure. And it's because so few people really do understand it. And this is being discussed in the news a lot and on this program. It seems like the sexy, exciting new thing that could unfortunately lure a lot of people in.
There have been a couple cases in Florida. There was a cryptocurrency exchange down in South Florida that got, I think they've had three lawsuits against them now. There have been people who have already been brought up on fraud charges. Yeah, I mean, the thing to remember is it doesn't matter if you gussy it up with ICOs and bitcoins and blockchain. At the end of the day, fraud is fraud. So if you're a dude in the sidewalk who's running a three-card Monte game, you're cheating people the same way that you're doing with more high-tech versions, but fraud's fraud.
Now, this is a field that I think is so wide open. I think people see amazing potential, but is that overblown? Do you see this growing as much as people project? The Securities and Exchange Commission has also created a federal czar position to manage this as
Correct.
Well. Correct.
And there's a couple different nuances to your question, which is it the way to get rich? Yeah, maybe. It definitely is for some people. Now, there's also the idea that many of those people who got fantastically wealthy out of it got in very early. And in any investment, the people who are in on the ground floor are probably going to make money more than people coming in now. The other question is, how big will this be? I think the first caller asked kind of was driving towards something about the dollar, Bitcoin, how they relate. If money is basically something that we all agree to believe in and people stop believing in Bitcoin, then it's not worth anything anymore. There's a lot of digital currency forks out there, some of which actually have been started as jokes, like a purposeful, I'm doing this as performance art. Yeah, they're probably not going to be worth anything years from now, but Bitcoin seems to have the staying power. It's actually being traded and bought and used by, you know, actual real companies.
Always great to get your insights. Tim Givens, he's editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
If you
Thanks
have any
for
Bitcoins,
being here.
You can send them to me.
Exactly. I'll get you a few.
Cool.
Well, finally, this hour, the 4th of July, is only a few days away, but it seems Florida is not getting in the spirit. The state came in number 30 in a survey ranking the most patriotic states in America. That is nothing to set off fireworks over. The study was done by Wallet Hub, a personal finance website. As they say in the finance business, take it for what it's worth. When you're barbecuing and setting off those fireworks, you can feel as patriotic as you want. Wallet Hub used two factors, military engagement and civic engagement, and graded all of the states on a 100-point scale. Florida only got about a 47. Ouch. Well, I'm still going to be barbecuing this 4th of July. I don't know about you guys. And my husband will be setting off fireworks in the driveway. He does that every year. And that is our show for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Kevin Mershart is our producer. Jason Zabka is our technical director. WLRN's program director is Peter Mertz. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. We'll be back next week. And finally, I want to take a moment just to remember the fallen colleagues who were shot and killed at the Capital Gazette newspaper yesterday in Annapolis, Maryland. One of them, the brother of Carl Hiaasen. The fallen, John McNamara, Wendy Winters, Rebecca Smith, Rob Hiaasen, and Gerald Fishman. Our thoughts are with them, their staff members, and their friends and families. Thanks so much for listening to the Florida Roundup. We'll be back next week. Have a great weekend.